You are listening to The News Project, in studio. Brought to you by GNAT TV.
Hello and welcome back to another edition of GNAT TV's in-depth series. I'm Andrew McKeever, the news director at GNAT TV's News Project, and it's a pleasure to have you with us today on Tuesday, May 3rd. It's also a great pleasure to be joined today by Kitty Toll, who is one of the candidates for the lieutenant governor position in the Democratic primary. It'll be happening on August 9th. Ms. Toll is a former state representative. She ran for the state legislature successfully in 2008 and served until 2020. And during her last two terms, she also served as the chair of the House Appropriations Committee. Ms. Toll, great to have you with us today. Thank you very much for making the time for our conversation today.
Good morning, Andrew. Thank you for having me.
Well, it's our pleasure. So I guess I just thought I'd start by asking you to tell us a little bit about yourself and what you did before you went into politics, since you come from Danville, up in the other end of the state from us southern folks down here. So tell us what you were doing before you ran for the House of Representatives.
Well, I've lived in the Northeast Kingdom my entire life. I like to say by choice. I had opportunities to leave if I chose to, but Vermont's a special state, and I happen to think the Northeast Kingdom is a very special area within this great state. I grew up on our family farm right on Route 2 in Danville. I'm the youngest of 14 children that all grew up on the farm. I was educated locally. We still have a pre-K through 12 school all under one roof in Danville, and that's the school I attended and graduated from. I then went on to use the state college system. I went to Linden State College and then on to UVM to do my master's work. So I have a real appreciation for the educational system in Vermont and the need for that system. I grew up with a mom who was in the legislature in 1965 for the redistricting session. It was a special session for 1 year. And I think the quote that I heard her say most often was back in the early 60s, she was a Democrat when Democrats could hold a meeting in a phone booth. And she said, you know, that wasn't too far from the truth. And so it was really my mom that planted this political seed. But after leaving college, I was a middle school teacher for 14 years, and then I had two children of my own, and I was very fortunate to be able to make the choice to stay home with them. And then when my youngest was 7, that's when I ran for the legislature.
So what led you to decide to throw your hat in the ring for the lieutenant governor's slot now? I mean, you left the state legislature 2 years ago. What prompted you to say, hey, I want to get back into the political game again?
There were two things that really shaped that decision and moved me forward. One was January 6th. I was watching the Vermont legislature go back into session and all the, you know, celebratory remarks and the speaker's remarks. And actually, I was joined by the former speaker that day, Mitzi Johnson, and I'm sorry about that. We were there to celebrate the new members coming in and to hear the speaker's remarks. We both, and I can speak for, you know, just for myself, me in particular, I just could not believe what we saw unfold that day. And I did not make the decision to jump back into politics that day, but as the news continued and we learned more about what happened on January 6th, And we could see, you know, just, you know, what it was doing to this country and this unrest and this divide. I really feel everybody has to do what they can to preserve our democracy. I feel it's fragile. I feel it's hanging by a thread. I'm very scared for my two children, and being a teacher, I am very nervous for the generations below me and what we're leaving them. And so January 6th was a real turning point for me. I love public service. I loved my time in the legislature. And I was going to look for new opportunities and new adventures. I didn't know what they were. But after January 6th, it led me back into politics to be a strong voice for Vermonters. And the other piece that really led me in that direction was when I was in the legislature in 2020, the first amount of federal dollars came into this state, the first $1.25 billion, an amount I could never have imagined. And I understand the state budget. I chaired that committee for 4 years. And, you know, that's just an unthinkable amount of money to come into this state. And we appropriated all of those dollars before I made the decision not to run, or we were in the process of appropriating those dollars and getting them out the door. I could never have imagined that another $1.25 billion would come in, and then infrastructure money and all the money that has come into our towns and cities. And my brain was just cranking as a former appropriations member and appropriations chair. How would I use this money? And, you know, I could, you know, thinking of areas where I would target it. And I know the Lieutenant Governor's office does not appropriate money and they do not work on the budget, but it allows for a very strong voice for Vermonters that can be used and heard in the legislature. And I believe I can bring real purpose to that office with the experience that I have had in the legislature for 12 years.
What are some of the major issues that your campaign is centered around?
Well, when I look at these dollars that have come in, and I look at the state of Vermont, where we really need to be concerned with keeping people in Vermont, attracting new families to Vermont, keeping businesses here and attracting new businesses. And with COVID, we have this whole new world of remote work. And that's a whole new population of people that can choose Vermont to work here, but can live here, but work elsewhere. The problem is, I see it as a three-legged stool. We have to have broadband everywhere, like we have electricity everywhere, in order to support the needs of all Vermonters. Broadband is essential. And, if you're coming here to raise a family, you have to have broadband. We have seen where families have been left behind or disadvantaged because they have to sit outside the library in order to connect when their kids were not in school and working remotely. And you know, that I feel that's an unfair burden on a family not to be able to have and I don't want to call it a luxury, it's a necessity just like electricity. So broadband is key to keep people here, to attract new families, and to keep and attract new businesses. Housing is a second leg to that stool. We can have all the broadband in the world, but if we do not have the housing to support people who want to be here, then it doesn't work. And for families, we have to have a childcare system that works for working families. And I see the three pieces really needing to work together as a infrastructure to support families and businesses and the economy. And then apart from that, I do have to say the environment. We cannot step back. We have to just move forward. We're small. We're not going to change the world, but we can do it. We can be a model, and we have to do our part. I truly believe in repairing and addressing the effects of climate change and creating a healthier environment. Frankly, I'm embarrassed what our generation is leaving for the generations behind us. And I feel all of us have to do our part to leave a better state and a better world for the younger generations. I'm truly embarrassed.
The state has already seems to have invested a fair amount of money into expanding broadband service around, certainly to underserved parts of the state. I guess I'm just wondering what more beyond what is already underway do you think we should be doing? Is it simply a case of the state ought to be investing even more money into that? Or is it a case, well, we're finally on the right track now and, you know, moving forward and let that process play out?
Well, we are on the right track, but our work is not complete until broadband is available, just like electricity. And we know we're not there yet, and it is going to take more money to be there. I have great faith in our CUDs that have been established around the state that will help move broadband into the most remote areas and not leave pieces behind. or, you know, pieces of Vermont behind, pieces of communities behind. And so we have more work to do, and there will be more money in the budget that has not been passed yet, but that will probably be passed this week in Montpelier. And it will probably not be enough to get to every corner. And then what is our plan from there? I'm a firm believer in what is our plan for the future instead of winging it as we go. Let's plan this roadmap out.
And then I wanted to ask you about housing, because certainly down here in our end of the state, that's a red hot topic at the moment, as I'm sure it is just about everywhere in Vermont. So I'm just wondering, if you were elected lieutenant governor and had a seat at the table on how we can accelerate building more housing in the state, what would be some of the things you'd be advocating for?
I'd be advocating for housing at all levels. I don't think we have secure housing at any level. We need emergency housing for people who do not have any homes. And I believe every person deserves to have a home. And so we need more supportive housing. There's many people that need these supports if they have, if they're addicted to substances, that they need those supports. They need transportation to get to jobs. They need supports to be able to continue with jobs. And in order to move that population forward, we need to have good supportive housing with the supports around them to help maintain and, you know, create and maintain success. We also need, more affordable housing for people with lower or modest incomes. We need middle income houses, housing projects. We need housing on all levels. And so I do not think that we can target just one area. We need to target to invest in new families coming here. And we also need to think of our elderly population, because we know Vermont, like all of New England, is growing older. It's an older population. And what kind of housing can we do to allow for elderly people who are able to still live independently? I think of my mother, who was 93 and had a huge farmhouse. She, you know, that was her home. But is there a shared housing style that would have, you know, she had lots of company and lots of people in all the time and actually always had somebody younger living there. But can we expand upon that model where, you know, you can do more shared housing? I also like, I'd like to explore more the ADUs, the accessory dwelling units, that are small houses, whether they're like a tiny house on the same property as maybe a family member or a caregiver. If you can live independently, but really could use the supports of somebody nearby, or, you know, renovating a garage or barn space that would allow for independent living for elderly people. And then there's housing projects that need to be located in downtown areas, so that people have access to the post office, to stores, to restaurants, to the school when transportation is an issue. And so all of these models we're lacking in all areas. And I see it again as a package. Instead of just targeting one silo, we need to target, you know, the whole farm of issues and move forward. And we have great housing groups. You know, in our area, it's Rural Edge. And across the state, there, you know, there's housing authorities, housing groups that we need to lean on and work together in partnership with them, along with our state agencies. And to address, as you said, the supply chain, that's way larger than Vermont because of the disruptions with COVID. But I believe, you know, in our schools, we really have to make more opportunities and allow more exploration for kids to become involved in them. And I call them professional trades. If you're a builder or a plumber or an electrician, those are every bit as complicated and important as being any other profession in the state. And I'd like to see more emphasis there and bring more people on board in those job areas.
This whole question of pension reform, since you were the chair of the Appropriations Committee, I'm sure you must have been following the whole pension issue quite closely over the years. And I guess I just wondered, what is your feeling about the bill that came through the legislature that the governor refused to sign, and what you thought of his action?
The pension issue is a very important issue. As we know, the problem started in the mid-1990s, in the early 2000s, when the pensions were underfunded, thinking that the rate of return would compensate for not the full funding. And that did not happen. The year before I came into office, I believe it was 2008, the full ARC, the annual required contribution, started to be fully paid again. However, we had this past debt. The time I was on for 10 years on appropriations, we worked very closely with the treasurer, and we added millions of dollars to that system, and we could not keep up. When I finished the last session, there were some data that was updated. The pension board updated some very important metrics, such as the cost of healthcare, the retirement age, and all in the rate of return, which was lowered. And when you lower the rate of return, that puts even more pressure on the system, and you have to lower it to its real value. Otherwise, you're building a system off not enough money to come in. And so over these years, we worked with the treasurer, we put more money in, and then ultimately a task force, a pension task force was formed. And this was the work of the pension task force. The legislature was also involved, and I believe a member from the administration was also involved in these early negotiations with the union. And over many months, everyone was at the table working. And my understanding is that when this compromise was put together, where the unions did make changes within their benefits and how much they pay in, we did have more money in the general fund due to all this COVID money that came in. It freed up some general fund money that allowed $200 million to go toward those past liabilities. We would never have had that. We never had that ability before. And there was also, I call it a smaller amount of one-time money left in the education fund that was able to be used as well. And I call it smaller, but in normal times, it would have been a large sum of money. And ultimately, with the agreement that the unions made at the table, along with everyone else that was negotiating, it would take approximately $2 billion off the liabilities, which is nothing to sneeze at. That is huge. What my disappointment is with the governor, is that he came so late to the table, offering a 401k option. That should have been part of the discussions right along with all the other pieces. To bring a piece in after a negotiation has happened, and there's a member of the administration that was at the table that I believe agreed upon on his own. He said he could not speak for the administration, I believe. But though any other change needed to be at the table during discussions and not dropped as a bomb at the end. It's just not how to work around a table. And the work is never finished. You always have to review policy. You always have to make changes and come back to the table. This is a huge leap forward to take $2 billion off. And I'm just sorry that the governor chose not to be in the early discussions with a 401k plan. And I believe an amendment that was taken away on the House floor would also had some sharing of expense between the unions in the state if the rate of return or healthcare was more expensive. And I'm not exactly sure about that amendment because it was pulled from the floor. But when the Senate votes unanimously and the House votes unanimously, Republicans, Independents, Democrats, and Progressives, I just don't understand how the governor can say, I'm going to veto this because I want more when I wasn't at the table during the original discussions and certainly would have been invited and included.
We learned last night that, it was leaked through Political Magazine, a story came out showing a rough draft of the potential Supreme Court decision on on the decision surrounding whether or not they will overturn Roe v. Wade, the abortion bill, decision passed in 1973 by the Supreme Court. And that draft, which of course is just a draft at this point, not a formal opinion to be handed down, but likely to have the support of at least five of the Supreme Court justices that would essentially overturn Roe v. Wade. I guess that grows out of that case from Mississippi that came to them. It's very early. We're just learning more about this almost as we're talking. What's your initial reaction to that? Because there is obviously a state resonance with that, since voters in November will be asked to vote on Proposition 5, which would enable anyone to obtain an abortion safely and legally in Vermont.
Thank you for bringing up this most recent current event. And I am disheartened. I am bothered. And I'm really concerned, as I said earlier, what are we leaving, you know, the generation behind us? When the majority, the larger majority of people in the United States, I think it's in the mid to high 70s, that support reproductive liberties, you know, support Roe v. Wade, support where it is now, for the Supreme Court to overturn something, you know, and I have not personally read the initial draft, but what's been relayed on the news that abortion isn't in the Constitution. Well, neither are other things, such as gay rights or birth control. There's all sorts of other words that are not in the Constitution, and to use that as one of the methods for turning this around is, I'm very concerned and I'm very disheartened. I'm very pleased with the state of Vermont, and I was there when we voted on Prop 5 in the House that would enshrine reproductive liberties within our own constitution. But I think a patchwork of policy across the states is not for a right that women should have is not the way to go. And I hope that there is pressure and that, you know, that the majority, the 78% or whatever percent the poll is that shows support Roe v. Wade in place, I hope their voices are loud and clear and united in making sure that this is not overturned. I feel we're going backwards. I worry about women's health. I worry about the repercussions because we know this would not stop abortions. It would just happen in other ways, and not in, you know, a doctor's office with counseling and support and, you know, cleanliness. And, you know, I am just almost at a loss for words in the direction it appears that this country is going, with our democracy at stake, with important legislation like this, you know, on the verge of being reversed. If I were a young person, I would just be shaking my head and asking, you know, what more are you going to do to us? You know, you've destroyed our environment. You know, there's wars, there's, you know, conflicts in our own country, there's fighting, our state capital, our U.S. Capitol has been, you know, invaded. I'm just so discouraged by what we're doing to this world, and we need strong people and we need younger people to come in and turn this ship around.
Yeah, there is obviously a lot more political division in the country now than I would have said existed 5 or 10 years ago, let's say. What do you think is the way we're going to kind of either overcome that or work through that? To enable people who are on opposite sides of a political spectrum to be able to talk to each other in a way that they can say, okay, well, I hear what you're saying. I may not agree with you, but I understand what you're saying and why you feel that way. And how can we kind of reach some sort of compromise? As a lieutenant governor, you'd be in a position to kind of, I think, facilitate conversations like that. And I guess I just wondered, do you feel there is a path forward for people who are really dug in on opposing sides of the political spectrum to have sort of civil conversations with each other and agree that in the end we all want the same thing. It's just a question of how we get there.
Yes, I do. I am hopeful. And I feel that we have to set the table so that people can come to it and invite people to the table. And we're always going to have people that are so stuck in beliefs that they can't compromise. But what we need and is the majority of the people that we know want to move forward in a positive way. And we all can't get everything we want. And we will not ever all agree on certain issues. But where do we find that common ground? And in like Proposition 5, that's a more black and white issue than other common ground as we move forward, you know, on housing issues or where to spend, you know, federal dollars, you know, in different methods for increasing broadband availability across the state. There are some very black and white issues. And when the large majority of Americans support something, that is when they need to realize they have to vote. People have to vote to put people in office that are willing to work together and are willing to move good policy forward. And there's so many people that we have heard over the years, oh, my vote doesn't matter. You know, it's just one of, you know, some huge number and it's not going to make a difference. Or if I can't have the candidate of my choice, I'm not going to vote for the other candidate. We are seeing when people don't vote and when they step away, the chaos that it creates, and it's up to all of us. It's not just a responsibility to vote. If we want a democratic system, you know, it's our mission to vote. And I know people aren't always going to agree, but you have to vote for people who are willing to come to the table, willing to have honest discussions, and are willing to negotiate. And on important issues like Proposition 5, then if that's important to you, as it is with the majority of Americans, you need to vote. And Congress should be able to turn this around with what we're seeing with the Supreme Court, but they're not functioning so well. And so you have to ask Americans, if they're not functioning, are there people in there that could function and get this country back on track? And it's the democratic process, and it's every ordinary citizen like myself, my responsibility to vote. And we have seen too many people who have not, you know, taken that opportunity to have their voices heard.
Indeed. Well, we'll have to leave it there for today, I guess. But once again, Ms. Toll, thank you very much for making the time for our conversation today. And good luck out there on the campaign trail. And perhaps we'll have an opportunity to cross paths again. The primary is, August 9th? But I guess early voting will start, in June or so?
At the end of June.
Far away.
And to remind people, there's some confusion, Andrew. The primary ballots will not be mailed to everybody. You have to request them. The general election ballots will be mailed to everybody. So if people are waiting to receive them in the mail for the primary, you have to request.
All right. Good point. That's good to know. Well, thanks again. And thanks to all of you who have been with us today watching our show. I hope you found it interesting. And we'll see you again the next time, of course. Meanwhile, thanks again. Katie Toll is a candidate for Lieutenant Governor in the Democratic Party primary. And good luck out there on the campaign trail. Thanks again, and have a good day, everybody.
Thank you for listening local. For more local content, visit gnat.tv.